Hello out there again, everybody. Welcome to this very special edition of the Moderate Podcast. I am Jimmy Davis, and we are only a few days away from Christmas, so Merry Christmas to all of you out there that do celebrate it. If you celebrate other things, I hope whatever holiday you enjoy this time of year is a great one. On this week's show, we're going to do a little bit something different. We're going to do our first omnibus special. So what I've done is I've compiled the three segments that I did on impeachment back in May. And I think because of what's going on right now in the world, it's very timely that we do this. So rather than have you guys go back and listen to each individual episode, which was episodes 41 through 43, which weren't just impeachment. I mean, that was the primary focus of those episodes, but we had other things that we talked about on those episodes as well. So what I did was I just cut out the segments for specifically related to impeachment and put them all on this one podcast. So I hope you enjoy it. It's a good lesson on the history of impeachment in our country, and take it how you may. You may put it in the context of today. You may say today's circumstances are completely different. Again, I think that you look at each of those individually, especially the first one with Andrew Johnson, and you can see the politics that were involved with that particular one. They actually impeached him over a law that turned out to be unconstitutional. So it's a very interesting look at the history of it. So I hope you enjoy it. Our website, again, is www.themoderatepodcast.com. Our Facebook page is at facebook.com/themoderatepodcast. And we are on Twitter at the Mod Podcast One. So again, have a very Merry Christmas, and we will see you next week. We will have another show next week. It'll be a pre-recorded show, but we hope you enjoy this look back at our impeachment specials. What I want to do today is start by talking about the first of the impeachments that we've seen in our country. And I'm going to throw Richard Nixon into that mix, even though he was not officially impeached. They had the impeachment articles drawn up. They were about ready to go forward. And then, of course, we had the smoking gun that happened, and that brought it all together. And at that point, Nixon knew his goose was cooked, and he resigned on the spot. So let's talk about the original, the OG impeached president, and that would be Andrew Johnson, the 17th president of the United States. Of course, he became president as a result of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. But it's interesting just how he even got into the position of being vice president. So he was born in 1808 in North Carolina. So he's born and raised in the South. He moved to Tennessee in his teen years, settled in Greenville, Tennessee, started his political run as a alderman in Greenville, and then became the mayor. He made it into the Tennessee state legislature by 1835 and lost re-election 2 years later. He returned to state politics in 1839 and then moved to the state Senate in 1841 and was elected to the U.S. House in 1843. Now, he then ran, and he was appointed to as a senator. And actually, no, I'm sorry. He, in 1853, so he got into the U.S. House in 1843. In 1853, his opponents gerrymandered him out of office, and he retaliated by electing governor. He was elected twice as governor in Tennessee. And then in 1857, he had gained enough support in the state legislature to be elected to the U.S. Senate. So back in those days, I think it was before in the early 1900s, there was an amendment to the Constitution that called for the senators to be elected by popular vote rather than by appointment of the state legislature. So at that point, it was still they were still appointed by the state legislature, so they were not directly elected. And so he was elected by the state legislature to the U.S. Senate, and he proved to be an independent thinker. Now he was a social democrat. Okay. Or a union, what they called a union Democrat back in those days. And so When Lincoln ran, because in let's see, I want to make sure I get this right. So obviously, he proved to be an independent thinker. Like I said, this was most evident following the 1860 election of Abraham Lincoln as president of the United States, when Southern states began to secede. While the secession convention met in Charleston, South Carolina, Johnson addressed the Senate and proclaimed his allegiance to the Union. So remember, born and raised in the South, but he pledges allegiance to the Union. Tennessee did indeed secede, but Johnson remained in Washington. And Lincoln, in March of 1862, rewarded Johnson's loyalty by an appointment as military governor of Tennessee. When Lincoln sought a second presidential term in 1864 and needed the support of Union Democrats, like I had mentioned, he was a Union Democrat, he actually chose Johnson as his running mate. And he was made vice president on March 4th, 1865, upon the swearing in of Lincoln of his second term. And of course, 42 days later, we know what happened at the Ford Theater and the assassination of President Lincoln. And so Johnson became president. So the initial reaction to Johnson's presidency, despite the fact that the legislature was heavily Republican at the time, they were very optimistic about his ascendance to the presidency. Even the so-called radical Republicans who would pursue impeachment later, they supported him. Senator Bob Ben Wade of Ohio said, "By the gods, there will be no trouble now in running this government." But those relations quickly soured as Johnson's views on Reconstruction surfaced. Within weeks, Johnson opposed political rights for freedmen and called for a lenient Reconstruction policy. So freedmen were, of course, former slaves. Including he wanted to pardon, he even pardoned former Confederate leaders. The president looked for every opportunity to block the action of the radical Republicans, who were very anti-South. They wanted to really nail them for the whole Civil War thing. And so that's kind of where this animosity came from. And Johnson had no interest in compromise. When Johnson vetoed the Freedmen's Bureau Bill in February of 1866, he broke the final ties of the Republican opponents in Congress. They responded with the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, promising political rights to African Americans. In March of 1867, they also passed over Johnson's presidential veto, and this became key to the impeachment proceedings, the Tenure of Office Act, which was designed to limit the president's ability to shape his cabinet by requiring that he not only appointments but also dismissals be approved by the Senate. And obviously you can see where this can be a problem. As a matter of fact, the Tenure of Office Act was deemed unconstitutional years later. Not necessarily in time to save Johnson from going through impeachment, but it certainly did. It certainly was found to be unconstitutional because it thwarted the authority of the president to assign the cabinet. That is one of the key rights of that's granted the Constitution. Of course, the Senate is granted confirmation, but the president can fire, and we've seen that recently with Jeff Sessions, right? He fired the Attorney General, put Bill Barr in there, who was confirmed by the Senate. So if that had been the case and you had the opposite political party in place, he probably wouldn't have been able to fire Jeff Sessions. I don't think the Democrats would have allowed that to happen. I think the Republicans in the Senate would have allowed that today, and I don't think it would have made any difference. But nonetheless, it was declared under Constitution. But the Tenure of Office Act became the key piece of legislation that ultimately led to the conflict that led to impeachment. So by mid-1867, Johnson's enemies in Congress were repeatedly promoting impeachment. The precipitant event that resulted in a third and successful impeachment action was the firing of Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, a Lincoln appointee, an ally of the radical Republicans in Congress. Stanton had strongly opposed Johnson's Reconstruction policies, and the president hoped to replace him with Ulysses S. Grant, whom Johnson believed to be more in line with his own political thinking. In August of 1867, while the Congress was in recess, Johnson suspended Stanton and appointed Grant as Secretary of War ad interim, so basically interim Secretary of War. When the Senate opposed Johnson's actions and reinstated Stanton in the fall under the Tenure of Office Act, Grant resigned, fearing punitive action and possible consequences for his own presidential ambitions, which obviously we know were fulfilled in the future. Furious with his congressional opponents, Johnson fired Stanton and informed Congress of his action, and then named Major General Lorenzo Thomas, a longtime foe of Stanton, as interim secretary. Stanton promptly had Thomas arrested for illegally seizing his office. This musical chairs debacle amounted to a presidential challenge to the constitutionality of the Tenure of Office Act. In response, having again reinstated Stanton to office, radical Republicans in the House of Representatives, backed by key allies in the Senate, pursued impeachment. So led by an aging and ailing Thaddeus Stevens, the Joint Committee on Reconstruction rapidly drafted a resolution of impeachment, which passed the House on February 24, 1868, by a vote of 126-47. Immediately, the House proceeded to establish an impeachment committee, appointed managers, and drafted articles of impeachment. The committee quickly produced charges that eventually became 11 articles of impeachment, and I'll read those what those were to you. Article 1, that said Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, on the 21st day of February in the year of our Lord, 1868, at Washington, in the District of Columbia, unmindful of the high duties of his oath of office and of the requirements of the Constitution, that he should take care of the laws. He should take care of the laws, be faithfully the Cliff Notes version of these articles of impeachment rather than try to read the whole thing. Here are the 11 articles of impeachment: dismissing Edwin Stanton from office after the Senate had voted not to concur with the dismissal and had ordered him reinstated under their power granted to themselves on the Tenure of Office Act. Now, the Tenure of Office Act was vetoed by Johnson, of course, and it was overridden. Number two, appointing Thomas Secretary of War ad interim, despite the lack of vacancy in the office since the dismissal of Stanton had been invalid. Three, appointing Thomas without the required advice and consent of the Senate. Four, conspiring with Thomas and other persons to the House of Representatives unknown to unlawfully prevent Stanton from continuing in office. Five, conspiring to unlawfully curtail faithful execution of the Tenure of Office Act. Six, conspiring to seize, take, and possess the property of the United States and the Department of the United States and the Department of War. Seven, conspiring to seize, take, and possess the properties of the United States and the Department of War with specific intent to violate the Tenure of Office Act. Eight, issuing to Thomas the authority of the Office of Secretary of War with unlawful intent to control the disbursements of the monies appropriated for the military service and for the Department of War. Nine, issuing to Major General William H. Emory orders with unlawful intent to violate federal law requiring all military orders to be issued through the General of the Army. 10, making three speeches with intent to attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. And 11, bringing disgrace and ridicule to the presidency by his aforementioned actions, words, and actions. Now, think about that. Think about those are the articles of incorporation or of impeachment that were passed, okay? Especially thinking about those last two. Again, impeachment is not a criminal process. The only result of impeachment is removal from office. That is not a crime. That is not a criminal event. You don't get thrown. If you get impeached and ultimately the Senate removes you from office, that's all that happens to you. You can then be criminally prosecuted for things that you may have for acts you may have committed. And you'll recall, I don't want to talk about anywhere about Nixon because we're going to talk about that in a separate episode. We're going to go over that in detail. But the point is that the House of Representatives can impeach for pretty much any reason they want to. Basically, what numbers 10 and 11 are saying are things that are exactly happening today under President Trump. Attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. And you could argue that Donald Trump does that almost on a weekly basis, right? I would say he does. Bringing disgrace and ridicule to the presidency by his aforementioned words and actions. He does that on Twitter daily, in the opinion of some. And right now, the majority opinion in Congress is that's exactly what he's doing. Now, there could be political consequences for doing this. As you recall, there were political consequences in the U.S. and in the House of Representatives when they impeached Bill Clinton. And so, and we'll talk about Bill Clinton on here as well. So again, it's interesting that this is what exactly happened. But, so we talked about the 11 articles of impeachment. Some of the charges were petty, but mostly centered on the president's alleged violation of the Tenure of Office Act. So we talked about those different things. On March 2nd, 1868, the House approved the first 9 articles of impeachment, with the final 2 articles approved the following day. Amidst tremendous public attention and press coverage, the case moved to the Senate. Quickly, the Senate debated and adopted an updated set of 25 impeachment rules, setting the stage for the first presidential impeachment trial in U.S. history. Excuse me. With Chief Justice Salmon Chase presiding, the trial began on March 5th, 1868. On the advice of counsel, the president did not appear at the trial, although he did agree to a number of press interviews during the trial process. Leading the president's defense team was Attorney General Henry Stanberry, who resigned his post to devote all of his attention to the trial. Interesting that that said, right? 4 well-known and highly respected lawyers also donated their services, including William M. Everts of New York, Benjamin R. Curtis of Boston, best known for his dissenting opinion in the Dred Scott case, Judge Thomas A.R. Nelson, an old friend of Johnson's from Tennessee, and William S. Grosbeck of Ohio. The defense presented a complicated argument designed to raise doubt about the senator's minds about Johnson's intent and to question the role of criminality in impeachable offenses. They argued that Johnson's actions had not violated the Tenure of Office Act. Since Stanton had been appointed by Lincoln, Johnson was not obligated to continue his service. Even if the senators accepted the act as constitutional, the defense team insisted Johnson could not be impeached for a mistaken interpretation of the law. Furthermore, they claimed that Johnson's intent was to test the very constitutionality of the act before the Supreme Court, which he had the right to do. The president, they insisted, should not be convicted and removed from office for misconstruing his constitutional rights. On the issue of appointing Thomas as interim officer, the defense team noted that Johnson was attempting by necessity to keep the War Department staffed and operational. The president's actions, they noted, had resulted in no public injury sufficiently yet grave to warrant removal from office. So the trial of the president included testimony of 25 prosecution and 16 defense witnesses, became a public spectacle as well as a constitutional crisis. We've been hearing that word thrown around lately. And that's, again, why I'm talking about this, because this could be a road we end up going down. It gave the grand orators of the Senate a chance to dazzle the public with their speaking skills, and the trial was conducted mostly in open session before a packed gallery. During the final deliberations on the 11 articles of impeachment, however, the Senate cleared the gallery and closed the doors. Acknowledging the spectacular nature of the trial, the Senate opted to manage the overflow crowds by strictly controlling access to the visitors' gallery through a ticket system. So they did 1,000 tickets were printed, allowing admission for a single day. There was a process to that. So the sensational in every detail, the trial ended in a dramatic fashion. Johnson's fiercest opponents in the Senate maneuvered a vote on only 3 of the 11 articles of impeachment, believing those 3 offered the greatest chance to gain conviction. On May 16, 1868, in a dramatic call of the roll, 35 senators voted to convict the president of high crimes and misdemeanors, while 19 voted to acquit. A clear majority
voted against the president, but the tally fell one short vote short of the necessary two-thirds majority to convict. And that is an important point. The reason the Constitution was written in this way is that the framers believed that ultimately articles of impeachment could be very, very easy to come by, because you just need a simple majority vote in the House of Representatives to pass articles of impeachment that go on to the Senate. But actual conviction does take two-thirds of majority. And also keep in mind that originally senators were not directly voted in by the citizens. So it wasn't really a directly political office. They weren't accountable directly to voters, right? So the thought was, and remember, they would serve 6-year terms. So the thought there was they were kind of insulated from the politics a little bit. Although obviously this became a very political debate, but it still came up short, because at the end of the day, what happened was, there were 7 of the 19 that voted to acquit were Republicans, and they defied their party to save the impeached president. And this is what was said by one of them: "I cannot agree to destroy the harmonious working of the Constitution for the sake of getting rid of an unacceptable president." In other words, they did not want to destroy the power of the presidency for political reasons, because of political disagreements. Johnson ultimately didn't do anything wrong, because it was later found, as I stated earlier, that the Tenure of Office Act was indeed unconstitutional. And so that's why today the president had the right to fire Jeff Sessions and then appoint somebody new, who was then confirmed by the Senate. Under the Tenure of Office Act, he would have had to have permission from the Senate in order to fire Jeff Sessions. Now, he probably would have gotten the votes to get that, and probably would have been a moot point. But the point is that the president still has the right to run the executive branch the way he sees fit. And that was what was happening here. And the senators were taking the stance of going, you know what? Yeah, he violated this act, and maybe there's other ways we can get around this, and we've made our point, kind of. But at the end of the day, I think they even felt that maybe there's some unconstitutionality here. And there was enough Republicans that felt that way that indeed did vote to acquit the president at the time. So he served out his term as president, leaving office on March 4th, 1869. He then became a senator once again in 1864 or in 1874, was actually in the chamber. He was elected to the very chamber that where he'd been tried and acquitted just a few years earlier, but he only served 3 months before his death on July 31st, 1875. So it's again, the point is that impeachment is a political process. So we talked about Andrew Johnson and the reasons that he got impeached. And remember, just to quickly recap, he was impeached because he violated a law passed by Congress, overridden that they then overrode his veto, that actually turned out to be unconstitutional. So it was a highly political impeachment, and they were not happy that he was defying Congress under that law again, which, you know, and then one of the reasons he even did it was because he believed it was unconstitutional. It's like, wait a minute, the Constitution doesn't say that the Congress has, or the Senate has, the power to approve firings. They can only concur with hirings, but you can fire somebody at any time. And of course, the Supreme Court agreed with that argument way later. So the second impeachment in the history of the United States occurred back in December. It was initiated in December of 1998 and rolled into 1999, which is funny because the articles of impeachment were actually initiated during a lame duck session of Congress. So it was after the elections, but before all the new members of Congress were sworn in. So it was interesting that that was the case. But this was a result of the Ken Starr report, which we'll go over briefly, and the background to it. Now, remember, we have the Mueller report, and there's going to be a lot of parallels between what happened back then and what's going on today. So we're looking 20 years back at a report that was very damning to the president. But the main difference, when it all comes down to it, the main difference between the Starr report and the Mueller report is the Starr report actually recommended articles of impeachment. They said, hey, based on what we found, we believe the president should be impeached, and here's all the articles of impeachment that we believe the Congress should consider. Mueller didn't do that. But what he did was is he presented evidence of all these different things that could lead to articles of impeachment, but he didn't actually, you know, explicitly tell the Congress, here's what you need to do. That's up to Congress. But as you'll learn and as you'll see, and if you've read the report, because it's clear to me still that anybody that supports Trump at this time has not read the report. There's no way they could have. The only person that supports Trump that has read it is Bill Barr, and everyone else that supports Trump just got all their information from Bill Barr, because why would he lie about it? The report's out there for everyone to see. So why would he lie about what's in the report, or why would he mislead us about what's in the report? So I don't need to read the report because he already told me what I need to know. He gave me the Cliff Notes version of it, as if that gives you a true picture of what the report really says. And we've gone through that on this show. And if you listen to that episode, I believe it was episode 40, you would know that there is absolutely damning information on the president, and a lot of it parallels things that Bill Clinton was impeached for, namely asking people to lie for him under oath. That is one of the things that Bill Clinton was accused of, as we'll read through this, okay? The other interesting thing was the Starr report did indeed result in some convictions, or the Starr investigation led to some convictions related to Whitewater, which is the whole reason this started in the first place. So let's go back in time to the time that Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas. And actually, it was even before that. So basically, they started this land deal, the Whitewater development. And it's a complicated thing, but it was friends of Bill Clinton that started this whole thing, the McDougals. So we've heard of Jim and Karen McDougal. And they were the ones that were behind this Whitewater deal. And basically what they were accused of is, you know, and the Clintons did indeed invest in this. But the accusations against Bill Clinton basically came down to that he helped them it's hard to explain, I mean, without reading through it too much, but the whole reason was like the dealings in that it was there any wrongdoing, and was there any abuse of power when he was governor of Arkansas? So that was the original premise of the Starr report. So originally dealing with the failed land deal years earlier known as Whitewater 1994, Ken Starr, with the approval of Attorney General Janet Reno, conducted a wide-ranging investigation of alleged abuses into the firing of White House travel agents, the alleged misuse of FBI files, and Clinton's conduct during the sexual harassment lawsuit filed by a former Arkansas government employee, Paula Jones. So, again, the Starr report took 4 years. So the investigation took 4 years, which is twice as long as Mueller did, had reported or taken to do his report. And he released the report on September 9th, 1998. Now, because he was an independent counsel, he was hired by, his investigation was run by the Congress, by the House. And remember, in 1994, that is when the House was taken over by the Republicans for the first time in 40 years. So, or actually closer to, probably about 40 years. I think it was in the mid 50s or so that they had a majority in the House. But then it transitioned into this thing about that centered around Paula Jones. So Paula Jones sued Bill Clinton for sexual harassment, because remember, sexual harassment is not a criminal offense, it is a civil offense. And so there's, the charges have to be brought by a victim of the sexual harassment. In this case, the alleged victim was Paula Jones. And so what Clinton was actually convicted of, because first of all, he tried to get the trial pushed back until he was no longer president. The Supreme Court said, nope, this is a civil action. You can stand trial on this one. The case can move forward. So the case moved forward. Well, then Paula Jones tried to get what she was trying to do is her legal team anyway was trying to put together a pattern of abuse perpetrated by Bill Clinton. So they engaged Monica Lewinsky in conversations, and they got to have her admit on tape that she indeed had a sexual relationship with the president while she was an intern. So we all are familiar with that. And we heard the audio at the beginning. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. Okay? He did not say that under oath. He said it 2 days after he made similar statements under oath. And it turned out that he lied. So he was being tried. He was being, charged with sexual harassment by Paula Jones, and he lied about his sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And so, when they say it was just about consensual sex, that's true. However, you're the president of the United States. If you have any sexual relations or any kind of physical, romantic, or maybe not romantic because it doesn't necessarily mean romantic, but any kind of relationship of that nature with an employee, that's sexual harassment. It is absolutely 100% quid pro quo. And he tried to cover it up. Obviously, he didn't do a very good job of it. It came out and it was talked about in very minute detail in the Starr report. I have not read the Starr report because I don't want to read that, but here are the conclusions that they came to. President Clinton lied under oath in this civil case when he denied a sexual affair, a sexual relationship, or sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky. Remember, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Number two, President Clinton lied under oath to the grand jury about his sexual relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. Number three, this is, again, from the Starr report. So this is this is what they outline as the 11 possible grounds for impeachment allegedly committed by Bill Clinton. Okay. Number three, in a civil deposition to support his false statement about the sexual relationship, President Clinton also lied under oath about being alone with Ms. Lewinsky and about the many gifts exchanged between Ms. Lewinsky and him. Number four, President Clinton lied under oath in his civil deposition about his discussions with Ms. Lewinsky concerning her involvement in the Jones case, the Paula Jones case. Number five, during the Jones case, the president obstructed justice and had an understanding with Ms. Lewinsky to jointly conceal the truth about their relationship by concealing gifts subpoenaed by Ms. Jones's attorneys. Now, before I continue on to the rest of these, I want to kind of go back a little bit because there's something I missed. Another name that we always hear about in this is Linda Tripp. Linda Tripp provided Starr with taped phone conversations in which Monica Lewinsky discussed having oral sex with Clinton. So Paula Jones files the lawsuit. Linda Tripp is the one that actually had the conversations with Ms. Lewinsky that they then provided to Jones's attorneys, who then turned it over to Ken Starr. At that point, Ken Starr said, hey, we've got him because we know he's lying about this now. Because we said in his deposition that he didn't do it, but we have a witness saying that he did do it. And not only that, but we also know that he's trying to get her to lie about it. Okay, so that's where we're at. Number six, during the Jones case, the president obstructed justice and had an understanding with Ms. Lewinsky to jointly conceal the truth of their relationship from the judicial process by a scheme that included the following means. One, both the president and Ms. Lewinsky understood that they would lie under oath in the Jones case about their sexual relationship. Two, the president suggested to Ms. Lewinsky that she prepared an affidavit that, for the president's purposes, would memorialize her testimony under oath and could be used to prevent questioning of both them and of both of them about their relationship. Three, Ms. Lewinsky signed it and filed the false affidavit. Four, the president used Ms. Lewinsky's false affidavit at his deposition in an attempt to head off questions about Ms. Lewinsky. And five, when that failed, the president lied under oath at his civil deposition about the relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. Count number seven. President Clinton endeavored to obstruct justice by helping Ms. Lewinsky obtain a job in New York at a time when she would have been a witness harmful to him were she to tell the truth in the Jones case. Eight. President Clinton lied under oath in his civil deposition about his discussions with Vernon Jordan concerning Ms. Lewinsky's involvement in the Jones case. Number nine, the president improperly tampered with a potential witness by attempting to corruptly influence the testimony of his personal secretary, Betty Curry, in the days after his civil deposition. 10. President Clinton endeavored to obstruct justice during the grand jury investigation by refusing to testify for 7 months and lying to senior White House aides with knowledge that they would relay the president's false statements to the grand jury, and did thereby deceive, obstruct, and impede the grand jury. And finally, number 11, President Clinton abused his constitutional authority by, one, lying to the public and Congress in January 1998 about his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, two, promising at that time to cooperate fully with the grand jury investigation, three, later refusing six invitations to testify voluntarily to the grand jury, four, invoking executive privilege, five, lying to the grand jury in August 1998, and six, lying again to the public in Congress on August 17, 1998, all as part of an effort to hinder, impede, and deflect possible inquiry by the Congress of the United States. Now, if that doesn't sound, at least some of those elements don't sound like what Donald Trump is doing today, I don't know what to tell you. Because he is telling people to ignore subpoenas from the Congress. He is impeding an investigation of Congress, which he has no power to do, because that if he's allowed to do that, the Congress has no power anymore. The executive branch is the most powerful arm of government at that point. They have a constitutional right to oversight. And Donald Trump is deliberately impeding that right. And that's why this is so dangerous. And that's why everyone is there, that Democrats are up in arms about it. And not even Democrats, because I ain't a Democrat. I'm not. I'm a registered Republican, actually. And it sickens me to see our party doing this. It sickens me to see how we've come to a point where our base has gotten so stupid as to believe this buffoon that's in the White House right now. And it saddens me to see this, because I thought this was the party of principle. I thought this was the party of moral justice, of morality, of personal responsibility. And they continue to allow Donald Trump to not take any responsibility for anything. And it's perfectly acceptable. It's ridiculous. If he has nothing to hide, Why is he asking people to lie for him? Why is he refusing to let people testify in Congress? Why is he telling people to ignore subpoenas? Why? Why is he not giving the information freely? Because we talk about that with the police all the time. When we see these police videos, the same people that support Donald Trump and saying no, he needs to refuse to kowtow to Congress, they're the same people that see these police videos and saying if they would just comply, there'd be no problem. They would just comply with the police, there'd be no problem. Well, if Donald Trump would just comply with Congress here, there'd be no problem. And by the way, I agree with that. I think when police tell me to do something, I'm going to do it. There's no reason for me to not obey orders because I'm not doing anything wrong. So I obey the orders, they look into it, and everything's cool. And then I'm on my way. It might be a little bit of inconvenience, but at the end of the day, big deal. At least I'm still alive and I get to go. If I'm truly not doing anything wrong, what do I have to worry about? What do I have to hide? Nothing. If Donald Trump has nothing to worry about, has nothing to hide, why is he acting like somebody that has something to hide? Why? Ask yourself that question. Why is he denying this? Because we've already had a report, we've already looked into it and found nothing? Oh wait, except that it didn't find that at all. It found a lot of things. And now Congress is following up on those inquiries because there wasn't an explicit thing like in the Starr report we've just read here that here are the things you can consider for impeachment. But just because the Mueller report doesn't explicitly say that doesn't mean there's not plenty of things in there that could allow Congress to begin impeachment proceedings. There are plenty of things in this report. And by the way, it actually relates directly to the issue that Mueller was looking into in the first place. None of those 11 counts that I talked about, not a single one, had anything to do with Whitewater. Now, again, the Mueller investigation also resulted in plenty of convictions and guilty pleas for other issues that are outside of the Russian thing. And the Starr investigation did the same thing when it came to Whitewater and other issues. So this is all they got on the president himself. And Clinton handled this absolutely awful, terribly. Number one, what he did was morally reprehensible. Number two, the way he tried to cover it was very sloppy and did not work out very well for him. I got to hand it to Donald Trump. He's done a better job of that. He's done a better job of covering it up and how he's done it. And as we'll talk about with Richard Nixon, of course, you know, the thing that brought him down was the smoking gun. We'll talk about what that means next time on the show. But you don't have that in Donald Trump's case, because he doesn't use email for number one, and number two, he's very careful about what he says to who. He's very cagey, and he's good at this. He's very good at this, and that's so hard to bring him down for it. And number two, that's why people can still sleep at night even and support him, because they can have plausible deniability that he didn't actually do anything wrong. Because as long as you just believe what Bill Barr tells you, then you can still believe that with a good conscience. And just pretend to, and lie to yourself to tell you that what Bill Barr said it was in the Mueller report was actually what was in the Mueller report. Did he quote it directly? Yes. Was it taken out of context? Absolutely. 100% it was taken out of context. So, what did Congress actually do with this? So, that led to him being impeached. So, in November of 98, with this all going on, this was actually an issue going into the midterm elections in 1998. And the House Judiciary Committee actually conducted no investigations of its own into Clinton's alleged wrongdoings because... and it had held no serious impeachment-related hearings before the 1998 midterm elections. And the reason for that is because Ken Starr had already completed his investigation, and then in September of 98 is when he actually released his report. So Starr was, of course, criticized by Democrats, which I think is funny, for spending $70 million in an investigation that substantiated only perjury and obstruction of justice. That's the exact same argument. It's funny. I'm telling you, everyone has the same playbook. Everyone's like, oh, we spent $30 million on this Mueller report that can't turn out to be nothing. And they're complaining last time that only substantiated perjury and obstruction of justice. But they're keeping out the fact that the investigation itself did turn out to have convictions when it relates to Whitewater. And as we well know with the Mueller investigation, there were plenty of convictions when it came to lying, perjury. Well, those are the same things. Perjury and obstruction of justice and, shady dealings with the IRS and tax fraud and all these things that don't necessarily have anything to do directly with the Russian collusion thing or the cover-up of same. The cover-up of same, asking people to lie, is a crime. That is obstruction of justice. It doesn't matter if there's no underlying crime or not. If there's no underlying crime, why are you asking people to lie about it? Why? Why are you asking people to lie? Again, it makes no freaking sense. If you really believe that he did nothing wrong, then ask yourself, why is he asking people to lie? Why can't they tell the truth? I thought we stood for principles in the Republican Party. I'm sadly mistaken. But in 20 years, if the tides are turned and it's a Democrat, everyone's going to flip the script. Democrats are going to be saying what Republicans are saying today, just like they did 20 years ago. Republicans are going to be saying what Democrats are saying today, and it's going to be all the same thing. All the same thing, because it's nothing but politics. 100%, nothing but politics. That's all it is. Now, obviously, we know what happened. There actually ended up being three articles of impeachment written up. Now, let's see. They impeached him on the grounds of perjury to the grand jury and obstruction of justice. Two other articles of impeachment failed, a second count of perjury in the Jones case, and one accusing of Clinton of abuse of power. So those two failed. But still two were passed. So that means we pass it on to the Senate. So the articles of impeachment were as such. Article 1 charged that Clinton lied to the grand jury concerning 1, the nature and details of the relationship with Lewinsky, 2, prior false statements that he made in the Jones deposition, 3, prior false statements he allowed his lawyers to make characterizing Lewinsky's affidavit, and 4, his attempts to tamper with witnesses. Article 3 charged Clinton with attempting to obstruct justice in the Jones case by encouraging Lewinsky to file a false affidavit, which we've seen Donald Trump do. 2, encouraging Lewinsky to give false testimony if and when she was called to testify. 3, concealing gifts he had given to Lewinsky that had been subpoenaed. 4, attempting to secure a job for Lewinsky to influence her testimony, quid pro quo. 5, permitting his lawyer to make false statements characterizing Lewinsky's affidavit. 6, attempting to tamper with the possible testimony of his secretary, Betty Curie. And 7, making false and misleading statements to potential grand jury witnesses. There's several things in there that Trump could also be accused of when it comes to obstruction of justice. He attempted to tamper with the testimony of Michael Cohen, for one thing, and of Don McGahn. He also directed, the fact that he wanted to get Robert Mueller fired, and he wanted Jeff Sessions to do it, and he refused, was to impede the investigation. According to these standards, that is an impeachable offense. It is. It's an impeachable offense. So, it goes to the Senate, of course. In when you have an impeachment, again, the House kind of almost represents a DA's office more than a grand jury even. So the DA's office of the House decides that, okay, we're going to go ahead and charge this guy with these things. and the punishment if he's convicted is losing his job as president. Okay. And this is the only process where all three branches of government come together as one, because the prosecution is the House, the defendant is the president, the executive branch, the jury is the Senate, and the presiding judge is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So all three branches are involved in this process. It is the only, is one of the very few instances where all three are involved concurrently in the process. And that's how serious this process is. And that's why it's only happened twice in the history of this country. With Richard Nixon, as we'll learn next week, there were articles of impeachment written, but they never actually went to a final vote. The impeachment process had begun for President Nixon, but he had resigned before the vote of to impeach even came down. So it was a Republican controlled Senate. However, he was not close to being convicted on either charge. In Article 1, where it talked about the lying to the grand jury, 55 voted not guilty, 45 voted guilty. And in the charge of obstruction of justice, it was a 50-50 split. And so nowhere near the two-thirds majority needed to pass this. Now, a lot of people are looking back at that history and going, okay, I think that we don't have a reason to go after this because politically it's going to damage us. And the article in the argument is because we know we're not going to get conviction, and therefore that may help Donald Trump get reelected, and that may help the Republicans politically. However, it is, if you look at the next election, although by the thinnest of margins, the Republicans actually took over the presidency and both houses of Congress. So they already had majorities in the Senate and the House. They held on to those, and they got the White House. And that was the first time that had happened in many, many years for the Republicans. So it really didn't damage them politically to do that. And I think in this case, especially if there's something else that comes out that shows, that kind of puts this thing across the finish line, and it puts the Democrats in a position that they have to impeach this guy, because it'll look bad on history if they don't. And if they don't at this point, based on what's in the Mueller report compared to what the Starr report said about Bill Clinton and the process that went through, you're changing the rules, and you're rewriting the rules. And what precedent does that set? Are we saying that maybe Clinton should not have been impeached? And that could be a fair argument. And I'll bet you there's probably, you know, a some number of Republicans that might believe that, especially if they believe that Donald Trump should not be. If you believe Donald Trump should not be impeached, then I can't imagine that you would think that Bill Clinton should have been impeached too, and that the process was not fair to him. But how be as that may, that's how it went down. Obviously, that's always going to be part of his legacy. But ultimately, it was an interesting process. It was kind of known that it wasn't a go anywhere, but obviously. And obviously that was the case, but, he was a highly popular president at the time. He had a 70% approval rating. And that's what pissed off part of the Democrats too, is that they thought, you're going after this guy because he is, he's very popular. And in some instances, it actually backfired on the Republicans a little bit, because what happened was at the end of the day, Clinton still stayed in office. But in the process, because of what he was being accused of, Newt Gingrich, even though he he resigned because he got the Republicans didn't do as well in the midterms as they did. And it was politically embarrassing for them. So he resigned. So then Bob Livingston became the speaker chosen by the Republican Party conference to replace Gingrich, but announced his end of the candidacy of speaker and his resignation from Congress from the floor of the House after his own marital infidelity came to light. In the same speech, Livingston also encouraged Clinton to resign for the same reason. Clinton chose to remain in office and urged Livingston to reconsider his resignation. And many other prominent Republican members of Congress, including Dan Burton of Indiana, Helen Chenoweth of Idaho, and Henry Hyde of Illinois, had infidelities exposed about this time, all of whom had voted for impeachment. So it actually kind of backfired a little bit because it's like, well, whoa, wait a minute. You're essentially saying that we should impeach this guy because he had sex with, you know, outside of marriage. Well, obviously that wasn't the case. What he was impeached of was lying about it to a grand jury. And the reason it was relevant to the grand jury is because he was involved with a sexual harassment lawsuit. And in this day of Me Too, it's very ironic that the Democrats are so out in front on that issue that back then it was just sex. But this was a clear-cut case of sexual harassment, as I said before. Here's an intern with the president of the freaking United States, and that's not considered a quid pro quo? Give me a break. Give me a break. That is a ridiculous argument. So there was a legitimate reason that that was hauled in front of the grand jury, and he lied about it, and he tried to get other people to lie about it. So let's not pretend he was some saint and it was just sex, because that's absolutely not the case. It was a lot more than that. And to gloss over that, a lot more than that part, shows that you're disingenuous about the whole issue. That if you're taking the holy high road on Donald Trump now, maybe you need to look at yourself in the mirror too. There's guilt to go around on both sides in this issue, no doubt about it. We talked about Andrew Johnson and his impeachment and his actually near conviction. He was one vote away from actually being removed from office. And, you know, for violating a law that was actually determined to be unconstitutional. So, you know, in Watergate, as we're going to learn, it's interesting because there was thought that you need to have an indictable offense to be able to actually impeach a president. There was a lot of congressional members that believed that. So let's go back to the beginning of this whole thing. So the whole premise of Watergate was a brainchild of G. Gordon Liddy and John Ehrlichman. G. Gordon Liddy was the finance counsel for the Committee for the Reelection of the President, in this case, President Nixon, and an aide named John Ehrlichman. They presented a campaign intelligence plan to the committee's acting chairman, Jeb Stuart Magruder, Attorney General John Mitchell, and Presidential Counsel John Dean, that involved extensive illegal activities against the Democratic Party. Now, Mitchell viewed the plan as unrealistic. 2 months later, Mitchell approved a reduced version of the plan, including burglaring the Democratic National Committee's headquarters at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C., which is why this scandal got its name, ostensibly to photograph campaign documents and install listening devices and telephones. So if this is a pared-down version of the plan, what the hell did the whole plan look like? That's what I'd like to know. That is, they must have been nuts if this was a reduced version of the plan. So the first break-in took place on May 28th at the behest of Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, who was a former CIA officer. So two CIA officers were involved with this. Former CIA officers were involved, E. Howard Hunt and James McCord. So those are important names. So the behest of Libby, Hunt, and McCord and his team of burglars prepared for their first Watergate break-in on May 28th. Two phones inside the DNC headquarters were said to have been wiretapped. One was Robert Spencer Oliver's phone, and the other phone belonged to DNC Chairman Larry O'Brien. Now, they found no evidence that O'Brien's phone was bugged, but it was determined that an effective listening device was installed on Oliver's phone. But while the successful with listening with installing the listening device, the committee agents soon determined that they needed repairs. So they plotted a second burglary in order to take care of the situation. So they got away with it the first time. What happened the second time? So sometime after midnight on Saturday, June 17th, 1972, Watergate Complex security guard Frank Wills noticed tape covering the latches on some of the complex's doors leading from the underground parking garage to several offices, which allowed the doors to stay closed but unlocked. He removed the tape, believing it was nothing. When he returned a short time later and discovered that someone had retaped the locks, he called the police. The burglar sentry across the street, Alfred Baldwin, was distracted watching TV and failed to observe the arrival of the police car in front of the hotel. Now, good God, these guys, for being as smart as they are running a campaign, were freaking idiots with how much they screwed this up. There's so many things that they did wrong here. The police apprehended five men later identified as Virgilio Gonzalez, Bernard Barker, James McCord, Eugenio Martinez, and Frank Sturgis. They were charged with attempted burglary and attempted interception of phone and other communications. Now, initially, Nixon's organization in the White House quickly went to work to cover up the crime and evade any evidence that might have damaged the president and his reelection. 3 months later, on September 15, 1972, a grand jury indicted the five office burglars, as well as Hunt and Liddy, for conspiracy, burglary, and violation of wiretapping laws. The burglars were tried by a jury with Judge Don Sirica officiating and pled guilty or were convicted on January 30th, 1973. Now, Nixon's own reaction to the break-in, at least initially, was one of skepticism. So Watergate prosecutor James Neal was sure that Nixon had not known in advance of the break-in. As evidence, he cited a conversation taped on June 23rd between the president and his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, in which Nixon asked, "Who was the asshole that did?" However, Nixon subsequently ordered Haldeman to have the CIA block the FBI's investigation into the source of the funding for the burglary. And that's going to become important later on down the line. A few days later, Nixon press secretary Ron Ziegler described the event as a third-rate burglary attempt, which, as I described it, is absolutely the case. On August 29th, at a news conference, Nixon stated that Dean had conducted a thorough investigation of the incident when Dean had actually not conducted any investigations at all. As in a matter of fact, he was actually involved with the original planning of this thing. Nixon furthermore said, "I can categorically say categorically that no one in the White House staff, no one in this administration presently employed was involved in this very bizarre incident." On September 15th, Nixon congratulated Dean, saying, "The way you've handled it seems to me has been very skillful, because you putting your fingers in the dikes, every time that leaks have sprung here and sprung there." So on June 19th, 1972, the press reported that one of the Watergate burglars was a Republican Party security aide. Former Attorney General John Mitchell, who was then head of the CRP, the Committee to Reelect the President, denied any involvement with the Watergate break-in. He also disavowed any knowledge whatsoever of the five burglars. But they found several campaign contributions that actually were deposited or otherwise. So there was a check for $25,000 that was found to have been deposited to U.S. and Mexican bank accounts of one of the Watergate burglars, Bernard Barker. It was made out to the Finance Committee of the committee to reelect the president. And the campaign check was a 1972 campaign donation by Kenneth Dahlberg. This money had been directly used to finance the burglary and wiretapping team's expenses, hardware, and supplies. And then on September 29th, 1972, the press reported that John Mitchell, while serving as Attorney General, controlled a secret Republican fund used to finance intelligence gathering against the Democrats. On October 10th, the FBI reported the Watergate break-in. It was part of a massive campaign of political spying and sabotage on behalf of the Nixon Reelection Committee. Despite these revelations, Nixon's campaign was never seriously jeopardized, and on November 7th, the president was reelected in one of the biggest landslides in American political history. So we've seen that when you have these kind of things come out, and now this happened right before an election, it obviously did have no effect on the election whatsoever. The connection between the break-in and the reelection committee was highlighted by media coverage, in particular investigative coverage by the Washington Post, Time, and the New York Times. And the coverage dramatically increased publicity and consequent political and legal repercussions. Now, chief among the Post's anonymous sources was an individual whom Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein had nicknamed, and you've heard this name before, Deep Throat. 33 years later, in 2005, the informant was identified as William Mark Feld Sr., deputy director of the FBI during that period of the 1970s. Now, during this early period of this investigation, most of the media failed to grasp the full implications of the scandal and concentrated reporting on other topics related to the 1972 presidential election. Most outlets, ignored or downplayed Woodward and Bernstein's scoops. Now, after the Post revealed that H.R. Haldeman had made payments from the secret fund, newspapers like the Chicago Tribune and the Philadelphia Inquirer failed to publish the information, but did publish the White House's denial of the story the following day. The White House also sought to isolate the Post coverage by tirelessly attacking that newspaper while declining to criticize other damaging stories about the scandal from the New York Times and Time magazine. So, again, it's interesting because the Post knew something. They knew something more. And he knew there was a leak, which is why they were going after them tirelessly. He was going after them nonstop. Does that sound familiar? It gets better. After it was learned that one of the convicted burglars wrote to Judge Sirica, alleging a high-level cover-up, the media shifted its focus. Time magazine described Nixon as undergoing daily hell and very little trust. The distrust between the press and the Nixon administration was mutual and greater than usual due to lingering dissatisfaction with events from the Vietnam War. At the same time, public distrust of the media was polled at more than 40%. So it's not like we haven't gone through this before that we're going through today with the media and this distrust of the media. There's history there. And one of the histories is right there here in the Watergate scandal. Now, Nixon and top administration officials discussed using government agencies to get or retaliate against those who perceived as hostile, those they perceived as hostile media organizations. At the request of Nixon's White House in 1969, the FBI tapped the phones of five reporters. And in 1971, the White House requested an audit of the tax return of the editor of Newsday after he wrote a series of articles about the financial dealings of Charles B.B. Rebozo, a friend of Nixon. The administration and its supporters accused the media of making wild accusations, putting too much emphasis on the story, and of having a liberal bias against the administration, a.k.a. fake news. So, fake news, trademark. So, Nixon's conversations in late March and all of April 1973 revealed not only that he know he needed to remove Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean to gain distance from them, but he had to do so in a way that was at least likely to incriminate him in his presidency. Nixon created a new conspiracy to effect a cover-up of the cover-up, which began in March 1973 and became fully formed in May and June of 1973, operating until his presidency ended in August of 1974. Now, urged by Nixon on March 28th, aide John Ehrlichman told Attorney General Richard Kleindienst that nobody in the White House had prior knowledge of the burglary. On April 13th, Magruder told U.S. attorneys that he had perjured himself during the burglar's trial and implicated John Dean and John Mitchell. So they're starting to turn on each other a little bit here now. Now, during the critical meeting between Dean and Nixon on April 15th, 1973, Dean was totally unaware of the president's depth of knowledge and involvement in the Watergate cover-up. It was during this meeting that Dean felt he was being recorded, and that would become a key as well. 2 days later, Dean told Nixon that he had been cooperating with the U.S. attorneys. On that same day, U.S. attorneys told Nixon that Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Dean, and other White House officials were implicated in the cover-up. On April 30th, Nixon asked for the resignation of Haldeman and Ehrlichman, two of his most influential aides. They were both later indicted, convicted, and ultimately sentenced to prison. He asked for the resignation of Attorney General Kleindienst to ensure no one could claim that his innocent friendship with Haldeman and Ehrlichman could be construed as a conflict. He fired White House counsel John Dean, who went on to testify before the Senate Watergate Committee, and said that he believed and suspected the conversations in the Oval Office were being taped. This information became the bombshell that helped force Richard Nixon to resign rather than be impeached. Now, writing from prison for New West and New York magazines in 1977, Ehrlichman claimed Nixon had offered him a large sum of money, which he declined. So, meanwhile, on February 7th, 1973, the U.S. Senate voted 77-0 to establish a select committee to investigate Watergate, with Sam Ervin named chairman the next day. And then on Monday, July 16th, 1973, Chief Minority Counsel Fred Thompson asked White House Assistant Alexander Butterfield whether he was aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the president. Butterfield's revelation of a taping system transformed the Watergate investigation. So Archibald Cox, who had been something important. On April 30th, Nixon appointed a new Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, and gave him authority to designate a special counsel for the Watergate investigation, who would be independent of the regular Justice Department hierarchy. In May 1973, Richardson named Archibald Cox to the position. So then Cox immediately subpoenaed the tapes once they learned that of the recording system in the Oval Office. So he immediately subpoenaed the tapes, as did the Senate, but Nixon refused to release them, citing his executive privilege as president, and ordered Cox to drop his subpoena. Cox refused. On October 20th, 1973, happy birthday, Dad, after Cox refused to drop the subpoena, Nixon ordered Attorney General Richardson to fire the special prosecutor. Richardson resigned in protest rather than carry out the order. Nixon then ordered Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus, God, I hope I got that, Ruckelshaus, to fire Cox, but Ruckelshaus also resigned rather than fire him. Nixon's search for someone in the Justice Department willing to fire Cox ended with Solicitor General Robert Bork. That name may sound familiar as well. Now, though Bork said he believed Nixon's order was valid and appropriate, he considered resigning to avoid being, quote, perceived as a man who did the president's bidding to save my job, end of quote. Bork nonetheless carried out the presidential order and dismissed the special prosecutor. These actions met considerable public criticism, as you can well imagine. It would have been if Trump had found somebody to fire Mueller, which we, from the Mueller report, know that he was trying to get done. Responding to the allegations of possible wrongdoing in front of 400 Associated Press managing editors at Disney's Contemporary Resort on November 17th, 1973, Nixon stated emphatically and famously, "I am not a crook." He needed to allow Bork to appoint a new special prosecutor. Bork chose Leon Jaworski to continue the investigation. So now we fast forward on to March 1st, 1974. A grand jury in Washington, D.C. indicted several former aides of Nixon who became known as the Watergate Seven. So it's Haldeman, Ehrlichman, John Mitchell, Charles Colson, Gordon C. Strachan, Robert Meriden, and Kenneth Parkinson for conspiracy to hinder the Watergate investigation. Grand jury secretly named Nixon as an unindicted co-conspirator. The special prosecutor dissuaded them from an indictment of Nixon, arguing that a president can only be indicted after he leaves office. The Nixon administration struggled to decide what materials to release based on that subpoena. All parties involved agreed that all pertinent information should be released. So Nixon announced the release of transcripts rather than actual tapes in a speech to the nation on April 29th, 1974. Nixon noted that any audio pertinent to national security information could be redacted from the released tapes. Initially, Nixon gained a positive reaction for his speech. As people read through the transcripts over the next couple of weeks, however, former supporters among the public, media, and political community called for Nixon's resignation and impeachment. That just goes to show how bad they were. The editors of the Chicago Tribune, a newspaper that had supported Nixon, wrote, quote, "He is humorless to the point of being inhumane. He is devious. He is vacillating. He is profane. He is willing to be led. He displays dismaying gaps in knowledge. He displays dismaying gaps in knowledge. Sorry about that. He is suspicious of his staff. His loyalty is minimal." According to Time magazine, the Republican Party's leaders in the Western U.S. felt that while there remained a significant number of Nixon loyalists in the party, the majority believed that Nixon should step down as quickly as possible. They were disturbed by the bad language and the coarse, vindictive tone of the conversations in the transcripts. I guess we've changed our standards now, because it's not a big deal. I mean, we know how Donald Trump speaks, and I guess that's not a big deal anymore. So, you know, today that would not be a big, that's not a disqualifier. I think everybody, you know, we've lowered our standards nowadays across the board on both sides. It's not just Republicans, it's Democrats too. The issue of access to the tapes went to the United States Supreme Court. And on July 24th, 1974, in United States versus Nixon, the court ruled unanimously 8-0 that claims of executive privilege over the tapes were void. Now, William Rehnquist, who had been appointed by Nixon and most recently served in the Nixon Justice Department as Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Counsel, recused himself from the case. That's why there was an 8-0 vote. The court ordered the president to release the tapes to the special prosecutor. On July 30th, 1974, Nixon complied with the order and released the subpoenaed tapes to the public. The tapes revealed several crucial conversations that took place between the president and his counsel, John Dean, on March 21st, 1973. Gene summarized many aspects of the Watergate case and focused on the subsequent cover-up, describing it as a cancer on the presidency. The burglary team was being paid hush money for their silence, and Dean stated, quote, "That's the most troublesome post thing, because Bob Haldeman is involved in that. John Ehrlichman is involved in that. I'm involved in that. Mitchell's involved in that. And that's an obstruction of justice." Dean continued, saying that Howard Hunt was blackmailing the White House, demanding money immediately. Nixon replied that the money should be paid. "Just looking at the immediate problem, you don't have to have handle Hunt's financial systems damn soon. You've got to keep the cap on the bottle that much in order to have any options." At the time of the initial congressional proceedings, it was not known if Nixon had known and approved of the payments to the Watergate defendants earlier than this conversation. Nixon's conversation with Alderman on August 1st, 1972 is one of several that establishes he did. Nixon said, "Well, they have to be paid. That's all there is to it. They have to be paid." During the congressional debate on impeachment, some believed that impeachment required a criminally indictable offense. Nixon's agreement to make the blackmail payment was regarded as an affirmative act to obstruct justice. Nixon's position at this point was becoming extremely precarious. On February 6, 1974, the House approved giving the Judiciary Committee authority to investigate impeachment of the president. And on July 27, 1974, the House Judiciary Committee voted 27-11 to recommend the first article of impeachment against the president, obstruction of justice. The committee recommended the second article, abuse of power, on July 29, 1974. The next day, the committee recommended the third article, contempt of Congress. Now, remember the timing of the release of those documents. So they had ordered the release on July 24th, and then they began voting on impeachment, articles of impeachment in the Judiciary Committee on July 27th through the 29th. And as you'll recall, on July 30th is when Nixon complied to release the tapes to the public. And on August 5th, 1974, the White House released a previously unknown audio tape from June 23rd, 1972. Recorded only a few days after the break-in, it documented the initial stages of the cover-up. It revealed Nixon and Haldeman had conducted a meeting in the Oval Office where they discussed how to stop the FBI from continuing their investigation of the break-in as they recognized that there was a high risk that their position in the scandal may be revealed. After explaining how the money from the committee was traced to the burglars, Haldeman explained to Nixon that the cover-up plan, the way to handle this now is to, for us to have Walters, the CIA, call Pat Gray of the FBI and just say, stay the hell out of this. This is business here. We don't want you to go any further on it. Nixon approved the plan, and after he was given more information about the involvement of his campaign in the break-in, he told Haldeman, all right, fine, I understand it all. We won't second-guess Mitchell and the rest. Returning to the use of the CIA to obstruct the FBI, he instructed Haldeman, you call him in. Good. Good deal. Play it tough. That's the way to play it, and that's the way they play it, and that's the way we are going to play it. Now, before the release of this tape, Nixon had denied any involvement in the scandal. He claimed that there was no political motivations in his instructions to the CIA and claimed he had no knowledge before March 21, 1973, of involvement by senior campaign officials such as John Mitchell. The contents of this tape persuaded Nixon's own lawyers, Fred Buzhardt and James St. Clair, that the president had lied to the nation, to his closest aides, and to his own lawyers for more than 2 years. The tape, which Barber Conable referred to as a smoking gun, proved that Nixon had been involved in the cover-up from the beginning. And the release of the smoking gun tape obviously destroyed Nixon politically. The 10 congressmen who had voted against all three articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee announced that they would all support the impeachment articles accusing Nixon of obstructing justice when the articles came up before the full House. On the night of August 7th, 1974, Senators Barry Goldwater, Hugh Scott, and Congressman Rhodes met with Nixon in the Oval Office. Three lawmakers told Nixon that his support in Congress had all but disappeared. Rhodes told Nixon that that no more than 75 representatives were willing to oppose impeachment, and Goldwater and Scott told the president that there were enough votes in the Senate to convict him and that no more than 15 senators were willing for acquittal. So on August 8th, 1974, Richard Nixon announced his resignation effective noon, August 9th, 1974.